the last 2 years have ceased now, and this is both due to conservation and demand destruction, and this is likely to continue. We have hybrid cars coming along and in production. The auto executives are testifying before the U.S. Congress right now, for example, and it looks like if they get any loan guarantees from the federal government, there'll be requirements that they produce fuel-efficient cars, and they stop producing these Hummers, SUVs, and things that are and gas guzzlers. Obama, his presidency is quite promising at this point. He has a fellow named Dan Reicher, who's the possible incoming energy secretary. He was the assistant energy secretary under in the Clinton administration, and so he's he's proposed various alternative energy initiatives, and I think he's on the right track. His proposals include many of the elements of the crash program of the Hirsch Report. So there's a lot of good things there. Now, the Bush administration has been a huge disappointment. He had no plan. Now, he did make the comment that America was addicted to oil, and Samuel Bodman, apparently, his own energy secretary, persuaded him to include that in the State of the Union speech. But other than saying that, he really hasn't done anything about the problem. There's been no policies at all. There are various other reasons to be optimistic. There are advancements in alternative energies. Mass transit is increasing, and so there are certain elements of the crash program coming together at this point. Now, whether these are strong enough reasons to be really optimistic is an open question. So what I've done here is looked at peak oil as a behavioral problem in terms of my own discipline, behavior analysis, and generally concepts and principles that are used in experimental psychology. So in order to address peak oil, it is necessary to have some kind of a crash program in which the effects of peak oil are mitigated. So this is you can construe this as an avoidance response, something that avoids the dire consequences of peak oil, die off, a 20 to 30 year depression or whatever. So an avoidance response is something that if you make it prevents or postpones an aversive consequence. Everyday example is paying your utility bills on time. If you do so, you avoid a late charge. So a crash program if you initiate it, would prevent or postpone peak oil in the same way. If the crash program occurs, peak oil problems, the really difficult consequences of peak oil do not occur. If it fails to occur, though, then the aversive consequences, the 20-year depression, the die-off, whatever, they occur then. So meeting the challenge of peak oil is a problem of successful avoidance responding, engaging in the crash program to prevent the aversive consequence. Now, this is a problem of discriminated avoidance responding, because you only have one chance to make the response, because peak oil is a once-in-history event. Yeah, it only occurs only one time, and it's necessary to figure it all out in advance. And as we'll see here, that's going to turn out to be quite difficult. The rest of my talk will be concerned. Most of the rest of my talk will be concerned with the peak oil and why it's a difficult problem. And there are five main reasons here. It's a non-recurring consequence. That's to say, it's a once-in-history event. It's a delayed aversive consequence. That is to say that the effects of a mitigation program, a crash program, are delayed in the future. They don't have immediate effects. They postpone or prevent peak oil. The predicted date of peak oil is variable, as we've seen. The predicted aversiveness, how bad peak oil is going to be, is variable. Some people predict a die-off. Some people predict a relatively smooth transition to a society in which we use electric cars instead of gasoline-powered cars. And the nature of avoidance responding itself is difficult to acquire. It's difficult to execute, even for animals and people in animal research as well. as I mentioned, peak oil is a once in history event. Nobody, the problem, main problem is that no one's had an opportunity to practice for it. For example, people who have been in an automobile accident are much more likely to wear their safety belts. Safety belts are can be construed as an avoidance response. They prevent or prevent damage to your body in an automobile accident. The same thing with preventative medicine. People who have had a heart attack are much more likely to alter their diet or engage in taking the medication they need in order to prevent heart attacks. If they haven't had a heart attack, if you haven't had an automobile accident, it's less likely that you'll do that. Peak oil requires zero trial learning. The future event must be anticipated. There are five elements in the peak oil discrimination. Peak oil will occur, when it'll occur, that peak oil will be bad, crash program can avoid peak oil, when must the crash program occur. These are all things you have to figure out in advance in order to avoid peak oil. Now, each of these elements here that I'll discuss is disputed currently. It's necessary to discriminate that peak oil will occur. Well, you have people now saying peak oil is not going to occur. You even have one fringe who suggests that peak oil was produced abiotically. That's to say it's not the standard geological view is that peak oil is essentially the remains of dead plant and animal matter from millions of years ago, up to millions of years ago. And there's some people who don't accept that argument. They suggest that it's abiotically produced due to the internal pressure of the Earth's core, and the oil occurs as a result of that. These people think that there's a lot of oil still available simply because these processes occur continually, and even now oil is being produced. But that point of view is not accepted in standard scientific circles. People disagree that peak oil will be bad. They discriminated. They disagree that a crash program can work, and they disagree about the lead time necessary for the crash program to work. The Hirsch report suggested 10 to 20 years of advance notice was required. But other people just don't accept that. There's a delay problem in peak oil. The negative effects of peak oil and the positive effects of the crash program are both delayed consequences. This is a general principle in experimental psychology that delayed consequences are less effective than immediate consequences. So when something is far down the road, people can't see it'll happen. You mentioned something might happen in 2030. People aren't going to get very excited about it. This is one of the major problems people have with getting people to respond to global warming. It's also a delayed consequence of CO2 production. So it's difficult to get people motivated about peak oil. If it had already occurred, people would probably be powerfully motivated to do something about it. In the same way, people were motivated to do something about terrorism after the 9/11 attacks, but before then, they weren't particularly, didn't consider it a particular problem. Another interesting problem is that people who predict a difficult peak oil future tend to be judged as incorrect because the bad events they predict are nowhere to be seen. Kunstler summarized this: my critics have taken me to task because I've so far failed to correctly predict the end of the world. Anytime you're talking about bad events that occur in the future, you're going to be judged in terms of the present. Like, especially right now, oil prices have declined, gasoline prices rather, have declined by half. And so my talk today is less compelling than it would have been last summer, for example. So there's also a problem with the variability of the delay problem. As I've discussed, there's no agreement on when peak oil is going to occur. And you can contrast that with the Y2K problem. When you had the year 2000, you had a specific date when everyone knew that was going to occur. So billions of dollars were pumped in to solve that problem. It was an avoidance response that was required, just like peak oil. But the Y2K problem had the advantage of everyone knew when the date was going to be. So PQL is quite different. There's not the same sense of specificity about the excuse me when PQL is going to occur. And DeFace, who's a former shell oil geologist as well, and a former professor at Princeton University. You can see his quote here. He points out that when you have disagreement about the data PQL, the public tends to dismiss the thing because there's no valid knowledge. I think this is the standard practice here, and maybe the reason why the Bush administration hasn't done anything about it. As I've alluded, people disagree about how bad PQL is going to be. You have people like Kunstler predicting a die-off. You have people like Henry Lovins at the Rocky Mountain Institute suggesting that all we need to do is have produced highly technologically advanced cars that get 80, 90 to 100 miles per gallon. So what this does, when you have people who disagree about how bad peak oil is going to be, that makes it weakens the motivation to do anything about peak oil at this point. You have some people like Kunstler who are powerfully motivated because he thinks there'll be a die-off, and you have other people who don't think that it's a particular problem. There are other important problems to address. So avoidance behavior is difficult to learn. One of the folklore of the laboratories that the animals, rats and pigeons, have difficulty acquiring avoidance. It's partly because when you make the avoidance response, nothing happens. It might postpone shock, but that's a delayed consequence. Some animals pick it up, some don't. People have the same problem as well, as illustrated by the examples I gave for example, seatbelt use and in preventative medicine. It's difficult to get people to avoid something, to learn avoidance behavior. In the case of a lot of avoidance behavior is acquired as an escape response. In an escape response, the response immediately terminates the aversive stimulus. So that there's a conservation, if there's a water shortage, for example, a drought, then conservation is immediately encouraged. Any kind of conservation produces an immediate consequence. You have more water. So when the water shortage ends, then the escape response, that is conserving energy, is maintained as an avoidance response. People conserve energy because they want to prevent future problems with future water shortages. But since peak oil is a non-recurring consequence, occurs once in history, you can't use escape responses as a precursor, as a learning method for acquiring avoidance behavior. So, and another difficulty is that once you have, if the crash program were implemented, critics would likely to complain that it was not needed. Now, you have some critics who complain that the Y2K problem, for example, was a hoax. You had billions of dollars going into avoidance responses to prevent the Y2K problem. But since it succeeded, the avoidance responses were successful in curtailing the Y2K problem. You have even some people who say that it was a hoax. None of that spending was necessary. And Thomas Hardy, the novelist, had an interesting quote illustrating this point on avoidance. A resolution to avoid an evil is seldom framed until the evil is so far advanced to make avoidance impossible. Some additional challenges in peak oil are associated with resistance to change. Now, this is a general behavioral principle that the more frequently or intensively a response is reinforced, the more resistance to change it is. The simple example is your children, for example, if they're used to having Rice Krispies for breakfast, this is kind of a repetitively reinforced response. If you get up one morning and tell them that they're going to have cornflakes instead of Rice Krispies, there's going to be problems. You know, what you're doing is breaking up this repeated history of reinforcement. Now, in the Western democracies, what we have is a very long history of opulence, various kinds of rewards, reinforcers for behavior, use of the convenience of an automobile, for example, commuting from long distances and using a relatively plush, commodious automobile. And so this has made all these behaviors relatively resistant to change. People aren't willing to give up any of the modern conveniences, or will have difficulty giving them up. So you have a relative inelasticity of the gasoline. When oil went up to $147 a barrel, this was really tested and showed that there was a breaking point at which people would switch over. So you had people, bicycle sales went up, you had greater use of mass transit, and you had a reduction in automobile use that was that hadn't occurred since the energy crisis of the 70s. So the American way of life is non-negotiable. This is kind of a verbal expression of this resistance to change. Both Bush Sr. and Vice President Cheney have made this comment. There's simply a statement saying that the refusal to conserve, refusal to do anything really different in terms of the energy use practices, even though they're maybe beneficial for both global warming and averting the effects of peak oil. So the resistance to change principle predicts that there'll be extraordinary efforts to maintain private motor vehicle use in suburban commuting in spite of huge and ever-increasing costs. There've been another problem that people in this movement have, peak oil, is that there have been many prior false signals of oil depletion. There have been five previous periods, but in each case there were new oil discoveries. There was one quote in the early part of the 20th century. There was Standard Oil executive who, they were having difficulty finding oil at the time, and he thought Standard Oil should go into some new business that had more brighter prospects because of the lack of discoveries at that time. This is the standard fable way of looking at this in terms of the boy who cried wolf. This has occurred previously in the context of oil scarcity, but it's also occurred in other areas in terms of people concerned with the various environment and issues. Malthus, the 1950s predictions of nuclear disaster. Ehrlich's predictions of limits to growth. None of these have been realized. I think it's important to emphasize that they're predictions in progress at this point. World oil supply is, though, nonetheless limited, and a peak will occur. So these prior signals of oil depletion are preventing people from getting a grip on the problem. Another difficulty is the history of technological advances. People have expected technology to improve various facets of their life. It's increased food supply. The use of mechanized farm production, for example, has increased food availability over time. The difficulty is that oil discoveries, as I showed at the chart in the beginning of the talk today, have been declining since the mid-60s. And this is even in spite of the huge technological advancements to improvements in oil drilling and recovery technology. There's the oil wells being drilled in offshore, for example, are as much as five miles below the water surface, and then they go hundreds of meters below that to get to the oil. So these are really reaching, they're using really mind-boggling, it's really mind-boggling the technology they're using to recover oil successfully. It's really reached an advanced point. But the problem is that people have come to expect that technological improvements will bail them out of any crisis, and this simply won't occur in the case of oil. It's a limited resource, and it's the first time in history any major important natural resource, has reached its peak of production. There have been a few rare minerals in the past that have been people have run out of, but nothing along the lines of a major resource like peak oil, oil. So what the Hirsch report suggested is that they use a risk management approach to solve the problem. And so what risk management does is analyze the outcomes, risks, and benefits of alternative futures and plan courses of action accordingly. So it's generally the case that experts in many fields tend to make future predictions as if a single set of outcomes is possible. This enhances the current stature of the expert, who seems to know it all. Experts are often wrong, though, and suggesting that a greater use of risk management would be useful. So if someone, for example, comes here and says that, well, you know, you're wrong here. Peak oil is going to occur in 2018, for example, and I know this, he's going to seem like a more important and well-informed expert of someone like me who's giving a range of values here, who's trying to present this in a way that that's well, you could consider wishy-washy, but it's simply necessitated by the nature of the data and the poor data quality that we have for oil reserves. So, in terms of risk management, Hirsch asked two questions: what are the risks of initiating the crash program too early in advance of the peak, versus the risks of initiating the crash program too late? And if you initiated the crash program too early, you might have an unproductive use of resources. They cited in the 1970s, President Carter instituted a coal-to-liquids program, for example, that was not economically viable, as it turned out. There were planned construction of manufacturing plants that would turn coal, in which the United States is abundant with, to oil, and that was, they had oil shortages in the 1970s. So those programs, those plants, were only partially constructed, and they turned out to be a boondoggle. They didn't, weren't successful. But it should be understood that there are the benefits of being too early as initiating a crash program would also include the development of alternative energies that would lessen greenhouse gases and have other desirable environmental benefits. And one additional factor, there's would be improved national security. The huge amounts of money that go to Middle Eastern oil, part of this money gets funneled off to fund a lot of terrorist activities. It's a relatively small percentage of it, but since so many billions of dollars being contributed to the Middle East, some of it does get to terrorists, to extreme factions within the Middle Eastern countries. And there's a group of called the of people, including James Woolsey, a former CIA director, who advocate moving to alternative energy simply for national security purposes. So Hirsch analyzed, if you're too late with the crash program, you get a decade or more of devastating economic impacts, a depression of that could go on for as long as 20 years. So risk management, this approach were taken, what you'd want to do is implement the crash program relatively soon, recognizing that if it's too soon, it's likely to have very few negative consequences and some benefits. But if it's introduced too late, then what you have is a situation where you have a 10 to 20 year depression. This isn't the way that people don't conceptualize the issue in terms of risk management now. What you have is arguments about people who's right and wrong about the imminence of peak oil. You have factions saying, well, it's going to happen now. No, it's going to happen 10 years from now. No, it's going to happen 20 years from now. None of these arguments should risk management approach should supersede this kind of thinking. And what you do then is lessen the negative consequences, which are pretty bad in any scenario. But that's the kind of thinking that would minimize the negative consequences, no matter who is right or wrong. Just have my conclusions here are that no really advanced crash program is likely to go ahead. There's a lot of impediments that prevent this from occurring, and the nature of avoidance responding, the non-recurring nature of peak oil that I've discussed here. as I mentioned, I'm a little bit more optimistic than I used to be. There's a certain elements of a crash program, a program of mitigation that are coming into play. So there's certain elements of hope at this point. In the meantime, people ask me what they can do. They have a list of things here that they can promote and try to encourage. Each of these items on this list are elements of a crash program to mitigate the effects of PQI. Thank you.
Excellent. Are there any questions on or off-site? I see several poppings on our off-site people. Now that you can see their images. Yes. Resounding on and off-site silence. Are we all too stunned to take in the possibility of a question?
Maybe the die-off occurred already.
I think it's before Christmas.
I'm just curious, Klaus, where you published this. Was it in the same psychological journal, or was it something else?
It's a journal called, I have the paper here, I'll show it to you in just a minute, called Behavior and Social Issues. It's a journal it's a psychological journal of behavior, so concerned with larger social problems of various sorts. So it received quite a reception. It was a good reviews there, a nice receptive audience. They have a special interest group that I'm a member of as well, and so they do all sorts of things. They're concerned with issues like this, issues of mistreatment of captive populations, of people who are, and even there's a, you know, some of, they have one of their articles was had to do with the mistreatment of pets, for example, as well. So it runs the gamut of various issues like that.
I have a question.
Sure.
Starting at the end or at the end, the difficulty of engaging in conversations without partisan political perspectives coming into the dialogue, at least in my experience. And it seems to be kind of more divisive along right and left lines where people view this rather than in a non-partisan manner. And looking at the list of recommendations at the end, there are all things that people on the left and other spectrum would normally be cheering for and wanting to do for this and other reasons or wanting to do anyway. And I was just imagining my frequent suggestions of those kinds of activities around various relatives I have who would have different grades of views, and they would also see those as being more left-wing, whatever, pathetic attempts to do things and unnecessary and fear-mongering and all the rest of it. So I just wanted to know if you thought about that and how to
I think
even a risk management approach might be a lot of language that could be helpful, but I
wonder
if you thought about that in terms of the paper.
Yeah, that's actually something, that's a good point. It's one thing I kind of made a mental note to include in the talk today, but neglected to do so. This issue really doesn't fall out on, a lot of this issue doesn't fall out on partisan lines very well. You have Roscoe Bartlett, for example, is a member of the House of Representatives of the United States. He's a very conservative congressman from Maryland, and he's been one of the major advocates of peak oil and trying to get the government to do something about it. And he's also teamed up with Randy Udall, who's a relatively liberal congressman from Arizona. And so, you know, they're working together on this issue. They both recognize the nature of the problem, and it really doesn't necessarily fracture on traditional liberal conservative lines. Matt Simmons, for example, is a Houston investment banker, and he's been a major proponent of getting people to do something about peak oil as well. But he's very wealthy, and you know, the epitome of old oil money within Houston. So, and that's true as of Charles Maxwell as well. But But you're right, a lot of the prescriptions, a lot of the nature of the growth economy is where you really hit the problem. You have the moneyed interests, the corporate interests, who all depend upon a growth economy. And so if you mention something like a steady state economy as an alternative to that, then you start getting a fracture on traditional liberal conservative lines. I just don't know what to do about that problem. There's quite a bit here that can unite everyone to engage in the problem. Then again, you have another difficulty, like represented by the Hirsch point of view, which views the problem very narrowly and has a transportation fuels problem. And he's focused on maintaining the transportation infrastructure and transportation practices independently of their effects on global warming. So he's been criticized for that reason. So you have fractures along those lines as well. People who are concerned about the problem of peak oil and don't care about global warming versus people who care about both of those problems.
I think we just had an offset comment that went too fast for me to see it all. Can someone read that one?
I don't know if you can.
Oh, we've got a J, and so we've had two offset comments. We had one from about that.
Martin had a comment.
Yeah, let's go back to Martin's, and then we'll. So Martin is thanking Lyle for the presentation of seeing similarities of credits and credit bubbles and crash, and points out that we wake up when the party's over, and then wants Jay up to here.
Oh, I think I can address Jay's point. This is on the left. You find that you see a dismissal of peak oil because it's considered kind of a plot on the part of the oil companies to convince everybody that the oil is scarce when it's really not, and there's really plenty of oil available. And Naomi Klein, in her excellent book, Shock Doctrine, has documented the way in which the Bush administration, for example, has tried to, and has been, or at least for a time, was successful at inducing a lot of artificial crises based upon getting people motivated in taking actions that would support their policies. To suggest that peak oil is one of these artificial crises concocted by conservatives or whomever in order to try and artificially make oil scarce is kind of odd. It doesn't really, you have ExxonMobil who's suggesting there's plenty of oil, and they're oddly agreeing with this point of view that's sometimes enunciated, quite often actually enunciated on the part of the left. So you have kind of strange bedfellows there, that suggest, and you have petroleum geologists who are retired, and they're the ones who have been the major proponents of peak oil. These are people who know the industry, who are aware of the oil production resources and the capacities. My point today is mainly to, advocate a risk management approach to suggest that in whatever future scenario, we should be prepared. I just don't think that if you look at the sort of people that sort of knowledgeable people who are pointing the finger to peak oil and are suggesting that it's a real problem, I think that outweighs this conspiracy theory that peak oil is concocted and a kind of a manufactured crisis. You have too many, the pieces of that kind of puzzle just don't fit, as indicated, for example, by ExxonMobil and the left, both suggesting that the oil is plentiful.
Just picking up on Deanna's point, though, it seems to me, you comment on this, that certainly in Alberta, I'm wondering this more generally, and certainly in Western countries or jurisdictions where you do have oil, that you do have that kind of heightened or acute sense of division on left to right, by left to right. And whereas, where I think that you would see people on the right in Alberta making that kind of an argument back, that this is a scaremongering on the part of people on the left or people with a liberal orientation, that in fact, and I, you know, my perspective is a bit of irrationality, but you know, people are concerned you're going to tell the goose, you know, this lame golden egg, if you make too many negative comments, and then people invoke the mythology of the National Energy Program, that this is a, and it becomes an attack on Alberta. So I wonder if you can comment on, you know, whether there's less likelihood, although I know that I think you think that a Republican you referred to this one passage, but whether there's a increased likelihood of that kind of polarization when you're actually closer to the oil.
I just don't know how this is going to play out. You know, I'm not an expert in politics myself, and so I don't follow political trends, especially in Canada. I haven't followed them, that closely. I'm at least provisionally hopeful at this point that people will recognize the problem. There's been enough instances in which people have crossed these traditional divides and recognized the problem as a geological problem rather than as a political kind of a, and ignoring any political kind of undertones that may exist there. So I think that gives me at least the hope that people will kind of address the problem in a unified way. That may be unrealistic. There are a lot of traditional political lines of force there. They're quite right, and I recognize them. But I'm hopeful that they'll be addressed in some way. I think the problem is there's more of a problem with the global warming issue, because there you're more likely to get a fracture along traditional liberal conservative divided lines, because it's not because oil is a commodity, for example, and so it's important to both the users of whatever political stripe, and it's extremely important to the wealthy, especially in Alberta. I don't. Does that help at all? I hope I'm.
Yes. Last
question.
Just
one
question. Your thoughts on how, because of the market pressures on oil and its role as a reinforcer in this whole process, then how does the economic value of oil affect, you know, the phenomenon? What can you anticipate, you know, as peak oil happens? Will there be changes in the price that will drive or exacerbate its use, or I'm just sort of curious how that economic variable plays into this.
Oh, okay. Well, if nothing's done, if there's no mitigation or crash program, then they're going to have a very acute increase in the price of oil and gasoline. So you have Simmons predicting $300 a barrel oil, which would translate into something like $10 a gallon of gasoline. Really unprecedented increases. Now, if you have a crash program of mitigation that emphasizes alternative energies, as well as people adopting lifestyles that don't depend on oil, moving away from the suburban commuting model, you know, there's a huge impact that those kind of things have. There's a lot of low hanging fruit. You know, just go out after we're done today and look at the number of people who are driving around in big pickup trucks and SUVs. And they're the only one in the car. They're not hauling anything. They don't need those vehicles. There's a lot of really easy things that people can do. So it boils down to whether or not, you know, there's any program of mitigation, either government initiated or simply one driven by market forces in advance of the peak. If there's a program, people are doing something, then the price increases will be lessened. If not, then there'll be huge price increases. There'll be price increases in any case.
So it sounds like if nothing is done, then for producers, they'll get more for their oil overall than if things are implemented. The same amount of oil will sell for a much lower price overall for a longer time period.
If nothing is done, even if something is done, the price of oil is going to go up. Charles Maxwell, who I cited he looks at the prices. He's predicted continual price increases up in for decades to come. So there will be huge increases. Does that answer your question here? Perhaps I'm not understanding.
Well, I guess I'm just trying to get a sense for, from an economic point of view, what's the best strategy for maximizing that kind of economic gain associated with oil?
If you're an oil producer, or?
Yeah. Will you make more money overall if nothing is done?
At one point, what's going to happen is that if the oil companies, you have Suncor, for example, and Syncrude, if they're making huge amounts of money while they'd be having a die-off, the government's going to intercede and take their profits away. And you can already see that just this year in Alberta, they took a larger piece of the pie. But that was advocated by relatively conservative people like Peter Lougheed, for example, and probably rightly so. The oil companies had a good deal relative to the percentage of profits that oil companies elsewhere in the world get. So I guess the answer is that if you have a situation where you have a die-off, then you have the oil companies aren't going to do well there. They're going to have a breakdown of rule of law, which is not going to help anybody, and there's not going to be anybody who's really going to profit very well. But if it's moderated, the Alberta companies especially stand to do very well over the next 20 to 30 years because they have a resource that's hard to extract, ironically. It's hard to get out of the ground, but that will make it last longer. But on the other hand, you have to recognize that there are legitimate concerns about global warming. The whole operation of the oil sands it's terribly environmentally damaging, and at one point, the realization that it's having a harmful impact may influence a greater proportion of the population even in Alberta than it does now.
I think in terms of all of those things, that we have to remember all of those externalities, the accounting that says, that's as simple as supply and demand thing is much too limited in terms of the economic and other values involved to really, I think, be meaningful. And we as a society or the oil companies or all of the above are going to pay for the negative effects that unsustainable and environmentally destructive practices create.
Yes, but on the other hand, you have the problem of resistance to change. The whole society is structured on oil. The whole society moves on oil. The agricultural infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, almost anything you can think of is. You can even look around in the objects of this room and see what's made of plastic here. It's everywhere.
I have a question about the psychology, I guess you might call it, of climate change vis-a-vis peak oil. And I'm just wondering about part of this, given the partisan nature of the way that people often view climate change and peak oil, and it's difficult to put those. And I'm wondering when I go the ethics of the peak oil movement, sort of ignoring the climate change issue, maybe actually doing more for climate change, if they could do that so that the people who think climate change is irrelevant might pay more attention to a pure peak oil paradigm than they would to a combined paradigm, which is maybe a bit sad, but at any rate, I'm just thinking about conversations with other people about these two issues, and that they're separated a lot. My experience has been that a lot more people who would not discuss climate change in any sort of positive way will consider this if they see them as being different topics and might consider changing their lifestyle because of peak oil, which they would never do for climate change because they don't believe in it and think it's a part of that issue.
I see. Yeah.
But so I just wondering about that and just about in terms of your arguments about, sorry, not arguments, just your ideas about how, why there is resistance to this and some of the psychological issues about the resistance to climate change as a topic and how that affects this this whole conversation, because you've listed a number of experts who are very right-wing who see this as a problem, but how much does that filter down to the average conservative voter? And is that because of resistance to climate change and resistance to wanting to change lifestyle or social entitlement or whatever? How do those things interrelate?
Well, let me, the first issue you discussed had to do with the sorry, just go summarize that slowly. You had a two-part question.
Sorry.
Oh, it's okay.
I'm very sorry.
Actually, I was looking for a notepad, so I didn't forget.
I'm sorry. I was just thinking, initially just about the possibility of looking at climate change and peak oil quite just distinctly to perhaps encourage nonpartisan dialogue.
Yeah. Yeah. That's see, there's a real opportunity there because what's the effects of peak oil are quite likely to occur much in advance of the problems of global warming, which are due to hit later this century, and in a gradual, incremental way. And so the problems of peak oil hit you right in the face. They hit you hard and much sooner than global warming. But there's an opportunity to address both problems because there's to some extent through conservation and less use of fossil fuels, both problems can be addressed. So there's an opportunity there to bring those two kind of forces together. And you have some of that represented by Jeremy Leggett, for example. He's written a book, and David Goodstein. Both of those, half their book is concerned with peak oil, and the other half is concerned with global warming. They see it as, you know, the problems being very much related. Then you have other people like Hirsch, and he sees the problem as peak oil. They don't care about global warming at all. But there is at least a possibility of using peak oil and the problems related to peak oil and the response that will be necessary to peak oil. They will at least partially address global warming. But on the other hand, if the process of coal to liquid fuel change is very hugely polluting. Even in China, there have been people who China's building some of these plants because they have lots of coal and they're importing oil. So they're going to have to address that problem. But even there, among the Chinese dissidents, not dissidents, but pretty, you know, within the mainstream Communist Party, they're pointing out that this is a problem and one that should be addressed. And ironically, it's occurring in China and not among us, you know. Sorry, the second part was, I didn't write that down either.
Yeah, that was a scary thought. Thank you. Just about the psychology in terms of avoidance factors, how much does resistance to climate change as a concept play into the avoidance of hearing the story of peak oil?
I don't know. You know, in individual people's minds, I just don't have a real sense of that at this point. I know that these people are resistant to change in general due to the opulence of our lifestyles. People in poorer countries, you can get them to change quite easily, you know, because simply by, you know, adding a little bit of money to their lives, they're much more flexible. But the opulence in Western cultures have produced both the resistance to you do anything different about in the way they deal with and use fossil fuels, and that impacts both peak oil and climate change, the difficulty of climate change as well.
Jay asked that people identify themselves from the ELC.
Apologies, Jay. Does anyone else offsite have another question or comment? We could manage to yield the microphone if someone has a microphone.
Hello.
want me to turn this off?
I don't know.
Okay. So you're asking me to raise their hands here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because no one is taking the risk of taking the microphone. Apologies to off-site people for failing to identify ourselves.
We don't know who we are.
Huh?
We don't know ourselves before
Jay. Jay Smith, I'm Joe Taylor. Senator Ward, Kennedy State.
Funny. Hi, Jay. It's Deanna Douglas here.
Hi, Jay. This is Philip. And it's Bob Taylor.
Leslie Johnson.
Bob Grant.
Is there somebody else?
Lyle, I'm just curious about this peak oil construct and whether it's been applied to other commodities. You know, peak oil. I don't know if there are other areas in which this kind of production scenario has been articulated, but is there a history to the whole notion of the rising production followed by negative effects of declining production?
Yeah, you can look at that issue and there are different ways. The interesting precedent is whale oil in the 19th century. It was widely used as a fuel for lighting lamps in people's homes, and there was no oil. People hadn't discovered oil at that point, since it's far underground. So whales were hunted almost to extinction in the 19th century in order to revive the get the blubber, the fat that was turned into an oil that people used to oil in their houses. And so you basically had a transition there. You know, you had the oil, the whales becoming hunted and existing in fewer and fewer, there are fewer of them, so they really couldn't be used as fuel for lamps anymore. And they, but just about the time that happened, as the price of whale oil was increasing, the oil was discovered, ground or rock oil, as it was called in the 19th century. And it was started to be used as a fuel for lighting in the same way that whale oil had previously been used. So Rockefeller founded Standard Oil not as an oil company that produced transportation fuel, but as a company that produced a fuel that people would use in their homes for lighting lamps. There's been no huge natural resource like. Oil that's reached a peak previously. I think there have been a few rare minerals, as I mentioned, that have been declined, but they have reached a peak and declined. But they were the kind of things that for which there are no substitutes were available. The issue has been raised in terms of solar panels. There's a certain rare earths that are required to produce flat panel screens to mix in with the silicon to produce the kind of screens that are needed both for the screens that we use on the computers here and in solar cells as well. So some people have raised the prospect of those declining. They're limited in supply and they're very, very relatively rare. And so that may interfere with the production of solar panels. Though, I don't know, we have a lot of smart people working on this problem. It seems to me they should be able to figure out some kind of substitute.
Yeah, in analogy to peak oil, to the regional, the regional impact here would be the decline of the extermination of buffalo, the near extermination of buffalo in the 19th century, which made people in Métis rely on, and they were just devastated and contributed to their marginalization.
Yeah, that's a good example. It isn't one that's cited much because it affected Native people who are disadvantaged and not they don't generally make it into the history books as being a major event. Yes.
I think
at
various points in the pull a firm example in my mind that deforestation and elimination of fuel wood resources has been regionally or locally similar to a peak oil situation. But economies were less integrated then. People moved or found alternative sources.
Yes, that's very much true. In Michigan, where I grew up, it was clear-cut logging was used in the 19th century, and so they had a huge and abundant forest at that time, but at one point there simply wasn't any more wood available, and the lumber industry collapsed at that point.
Thinking of the fishing industry out in the Atlantic as well, probably is similar. It seems that what makes peak oil unique is its universality as opposed to these more locally distributed shortages.
Ronald Ray has talked about the East Ohio.
Yes.
And more focused example because it was a big thing in those.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that could be used, you could describe that as an overshoot in a kind of a microcosmic way, yes.
Well, I think our global linkages today make it, harder to get around this issue if you're talking about a global scale problem and global scale consequences.
Yeah, the Europeans generally are better equipped right now to handle. They have an excellent rail system that minimizes the use of transportation fuel, and they've also had heavy taxes on petroleum products for many years now. Joe Clark tried to introduce a 50 cents a gallon or 50 cents a liter, perhaps, a tax, and he was voted out of office at the time. So, unfortunately, those kind of proposals would put us in a better situation today had there been implemented, had there been taxes, and so people would have adjusted better to the potential decline that we're facing now. Is that what's happened now? You have to stay tuned to the latest news to know what's happening. Yeah.
So do we have any other off-site presentation or questions for our presenter? I see some of our off-site people have been part of the cyberspace connection here. Yes, no? Motion to adjourn.
Thank you, everybody.
It looks like we have no further questions here, so perhaps we should thank our speakers. Thanks for coming out, everybody.